1, 2, 3, 4.
Ich heiße Kirsten Bär und ich bin im Militär.
Nein, 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 nein.
Die Vertrag, ich am und dir handeln wie ein Offizier.
Ja, nein, 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 nein.
Please join me in welcoming Jack Zients.
Thank you. Just to introduce myself really quick, in addition to my irrelevant day job, I write for the last 3 years, I like it, but it's not relevant for right now. I write a almost daily blog on Jewish music called Teruah. I've been doing this for about 3 years. I came into writing that knowing absolutely nothing, and now I know a percentage or two more than absolutely nothing. I know maybe a little bit of what there is to know about Jewish music. I'm not a musicologist. I'm not a musician in any useful definition of being a musician. I'm a fan with a lot of enthusiasm. I'm going to assume that everybody in the room knows something that they're interested in, and they probably know more than me about it. But what I hope to offer everybody today is a wide picture of something that's going on right now that I'm really excited about, and I don't think people really understand the magnitude of what's going on. So if there's one argument I'm making in today's talk, something really exciting is happening and people need to know about it. And hopefully I'll be able to explain that in a lot of detail as we go. So I was born in 1970. Jewish music for me didn't exist. You know, I could bust into Hava Nagila right now. I'll spare you. I didn't spare the people at Ignite. You're already one step over them, right? Other than the liturgical music I sang in shul, other than Hava Nagila, other than Fiddler on the Roof, you know, I mean, that's about it, right? It was pretty barren. And I loved music. If there had been somebody singing about something Jewish on the radio, I would have known about it. It wasn't happening. That always kind of perplexed me. All these Jews are supposed to be in the media. How come we're not doing anything Jewish? But that's the way it was. So when I started getting interested in Jewish music, I wasn't really expecting to find an awful lot. Boy, was I wrong. So this is a brief snapshot of what's out there, which I'll expand on. This is a tag cloud, for people who are familiar with it, that comes from my own website. This is the stuff that I've been writing about for 3 years, okay? You know, the comparison between the last slide and this slide, I hope, is a little bit striking. There is an amazing amount of music being made in a lot of different Jewish communities, in a lot of different musical forms, and for different purposes. Okay, to get that started, I'll talk about klezmer. Okay, klezmer is the first place people typically start when they talk about Jewish music in the United States in the last 30 years. The klezmer music comes from 1800s Europe through 1920s New York, through 1950s New York, through 1970s New York, and now spread around the country. I'll give you an example. Klezmer is kind of a confusing topic to talk about because it never actually really existed, but it did really exist. So there's lots of different styles of music and different kinds of musicians that have all been kind of clumped together under this one term, klezmer, and they never really ever were, but by clumping them, we kind of can get a sense of what was going on. And so from a 2010 perspective, we can break klezmer down in a couple of different kind of categories. So first of all, there's the shtetl band. And by the way, klezmer musicians will probably be really mad at me for the way I'm about to describe all of this, but they know that I'm right. So there's the shtetl band. The shtetl band is a bunch of musicians who think that the music made in the Pale of Settlement in the 1800s is absolutely fabulous and needs to be preserved for the next generation. And of course they're right, okay? And there are a number of wonderful, wonderful musicians and bands that are doing this all around the country and all around the world. So here's an example of what they think the 1800s Pale of Settlement sounded like, or at least in the shtetl, as opposed to the urban centers. You can hear that wonderful, mournful, kind of almost cantorial liturgical tone, and that's the cymbalom, the nice kind of rhythmic sound underneath it. Okay? So that's one, that's klezmer focusing in on the 1800s. So then there's klezmer coming out of the turn of the last century. So the next, this is the revival. In the 1970s, a bunch of musicians started playing klezmer music again, and their touchstones was New York City primarily, but also Detroit and also Cleveland, a bunch of other areas coming out of the 1920s. Almost a little bit of a big band sound. Yeah, that was Shirim, a wonderful band out of Boston. Okay, but Jewish music and the klezmer music tradition continued, picking up the Latin craze of the 1950s. Just as much legitimately part of the klezmer tradition, though not nearly as recognizable. And just to make a point, a number of the bands I'm going to play are not from New York. It's heretical to say that, but not all Jewish music happened in New York. Not all Jews are in New York, which I'm sure at least a few people in the audience can agree with. In fact, the band I'm about to play, Yiddishkoop, is from Ohio. And they play up here in Ann Arbor every year at the Ark. They put on a wonderful, wonderful show. Nothing like the first few bands. Different. These guys are a klezmer band. Okay? Big difference, but they're keying in on different parts of Jewish history. Okay? And I also have to acknowledge the Simca band, right? I'm not going to play a particular recording, but one of the things that's happened in the last 30 years is that we went from there not really being any place to go hear klezmer around to basically now any urban center that has any Jews at all is going to have at least one band that'll play your wedding and play klezmer. And that's a great, great thing. That picture up there is a fellow named David Mark Klein from the Heartland Klezmerim, a wonderful band from Lansing. They're available to play parties. They're fabulous, right? And they can do any of these things. So, but this is a progressing out arc, right? None of this, so switching gears real quickly, to something that, again, is going to sound an awful lot like and not at all like the first couple of bands. This is David Krakauer and DJ So-Called. Back that off a little bit. What's happening now is you're seeing bands coming out of this tradition, picking up rock, picking up hip-hop, picking up jazz. And we're going to hear a lot more of this kind of stuff as we go forward. Certainly it's not the Shtetl band, but just as much klezmer. Okay. Okay, the next band I'm going to play, I'm going to skip over one to another Michigan band. There are Jews in Michigan. Red Sea Pedestrians. A lot of klezmer music has been picked up by the world music community. Roots rock of all types around the world. Klezmer's fitting right into it. So Red Sea Pedestrians is a wonderful roots band out of Kalamazoo. Definite klezmer feel. Again, a whole bunch of different approaches. They also play in Ann Arbor all the time. They were here last week. We missed them, but they'll be back. So one of the things that's confusing about klezmer, though, is that klezmer, as it's kind of got defined through the klezmer revival, tends to be very instrumental music. Clarinet, violin, cymbalom, instrumental music. Sometimes you see klezmer bands that have people singing in Yiddish, but that's kind of a second stage show piece. But Yiddish was a language. Klezmer is a music that sounds like a spoken language. People have been singing in that language as long as there's been a language, right? So there's been all wide variety of musical forms coming out of the Pale of Settlement that was not specifically klezmer, but is still being very, very actively done. And in fact, some of the more exciting music that's being made right now are people who are singing in Yiddish, but not to anything that sounds like klezmer. So I'll give you an example. And once again, I am quite deliberately focusing on local folks. So this is a fellow named Daniel Kahn
from
Michigan.
Ein, zwei, drei, vier.
Sich hier sind wir und nicht in den Militär.
Nein, 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 nein.
Stufe drog ich am und dir, handeln wie ein Offizier.
Ja, nein, 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 nein.
So Daniel Kahn isn't referencing klezmer in his music. What he's referencing is urban, Yiddish, socialist, anarchist cabaret music from the Weimar 30s. Okay? He comes at it from a totally different perspective. In fact, I had a wonderful conversation with him. I asked him to what degree does he consider himself a Jewish musician, and he was a little snippy with me. And this is fine, right? Because you know he's coming at this, and he's latched on to this form of music, both because of his own cultural history, but because he's a socialist anarchist, right? This is a music that speaks directly to his political and social orientation, but it's also a place where something that he can offer. So that's one great example. Give me another quick example. I mentioned the roots rock connection.
Zehn Brüder sind in mir gewesen, haben mir gehandelt in Wahn. Sind in eins in ins gestorben, sind in mir geblieben nah. Nein, Brüder sind in mir gewesen, haben mir gehandelt in Pracht. Seine eins bin ins gestorben, sind in mir geblieben acht.
So again, Yiddish music is a much wider array of sounds. I'm going to give you one last example, and this is an album that's been on, at least for a while, was on heavy rotation in my house. Tanya Solnick, this is the black album kind of in the middle, put together a wonderful album, gotta find it here, of Yiddish and Sephardic lullabies. I'll talk about Sephardic music in a moment, but this is a wonderful example of Yiddish folk music.
In the base Hamikdash, in a winkel cheder, sitzt die Almone Bastille.
Okay, so Pale of Settlement, Ashkenazi Jewry of the 1800s, has left an indelible imprint on Jewish music in the year 2010, but a diffuse one. Right, it's broken off in lots of really different, interesting directions, but it is not the show, or it is not the whole show of what's going on in Jewish music by any stretch. So, first of all, Sephardic Judaism and Sephardic culture is making a really strong cultural comeback in the United States right now. Sephardic Jews are Jews from Spain, Portugal, Italy, Greece. The Jews who were expelled from Spain, migrating west and south in the late 14 and 1500s. Okay? A relationship, very strong relationship with the Ashkenazi Jewry of Eastern Europe, but a very, very different culture. And very, very different music. So, also the Mizrahi Jews, which is the further group, we're talking the Eastern Mediterranean, Jordan, Libya, Israel, Egypt, along the Middle Eastern Rim. Again, absolute normative Judaism, but very different cultural bases than the Ashkenazi Jewry, as can be shown in their music. So I'm going to play you a couple of different clips. I'm going to start off with one of my personal favorite albums, which is the one up the top far right corner by a group called Pharaoh's Daughter. This is a Mizrahi-influenced track. So Mizrahi Judaism has very much Arab flavor in the language, in the music, going back to the Spanish Judaism, the Spanish Sephardic music. Here's a wonderful example of an indie pop band out of New York, we'll give New York credit, that picks up on the Sephardic music. You'll hear a wonderful kind of romantic lyricism you don't hear in the Ashkenazi.
El amor de edad de 15 años empecías el amor con un mancebico brigante que me pudo arrebatar con un mancebico brigante que me pudo arrebatar el oficio de mi querido.
Okay, and the one last group that I want to talk about really quickly, which is a kind of a secondary offshoot of the Sephardic community, is the Latino Jewish community, which isn't always Sephardic, but often associates itself with Sephardic Judaism. The Sephardic Jewish community, understand that as Jews were expelled from Spain, some of them got on the boat to the New World, right? Brazil, United States, lots of North and South American countries had strong Sephardic populations long before they had any Ashkenazic Jewish populations. In fact, I was having a nice email discussion with a cantor in Brazil last week who was basically explaining to me how Brazil was founded by Jews, and anybody who tells you otherwise doesn't know the history properly. Yes, the ships were Portuguese, but that doesn't mean there were that many Portuguese on the ships. All right, and so going back to because of this, there's been a whole long tradition of South American and Central American Jews who have their own culture, not necessarily as well defined in many cases. In a lot of cases, it's actually submerged and hidden. Their own families don't talk about it much. We can have a discussion at some other point about the whole Converso tradition. But here's a great example of a LA-based Latino Jewish group. This is not a nice, friendly, lyrical group. These guys are hip-hop. They are sarcastic. They are great fun.
I'm on the bike. I'm a crazy kike. I'm a year. Gonna blow my lid. My scent is fresh. Like a pound of flesh when it's large. I'm a crazy kike, I'm a yeah. Gonna pull my lid and the sun is fresh. Like a pound of flesh.
Okay, so the first thought here, right, is that the Ashkenazi Jewish experience and Jewish music is amazing and wonderful, but it's one narrow slice of what's going on in the musical landscape right now. So moving past Sephardic and Mizrahi, I'm going to take a step back from kind of these cultural splits and talk about kind of highbrow versus lowbrow music. To some degree, all of what we've just heard is kind of lowbrow stuff, right? We're talking folk musics. We're talking about hip-hop. We're talking things that are more popular culture as opposed to high art culture, right? But Jewish music has got a very strong activity in high art culture and always has. Two kind of pivotal points in that over the last 10 years have been the Radical Jewish Culture Label and the Milken Archive of Jewish Music. So this Radical Jewish Culture is a record imprint put out by jazz saxophone player John Zorn. John Zorn is avant-garde, almost the definition of avant-garde jazz. In fact, he's so avant-garde that half the time what he's playing doesn't sound like jazz. That's how you know he's avant-garde, All right. And a while ago, he kind of, I say, he got religion, but not necessarily in a religious sense, but he started, for a variety of reasons, becoming more interested in his own Jewish past, in his own Jewish culture, and put his money where his thoughts were, and started doling out chunks of money to musical groups to put out a Jewish album and to push the bounds of what Jewish music could sound like and should sound like. At this point, there's well over 100 albums. I have yet to hear one that wasn't outstanding. I don't like them all equally. You know, I have my own taste in music, but they're all phenomenal. So I'm going to give you a couple brief clips of what John Zorn thinks is really exciting. So we're going to start with one of my personal favorites, but and I'll betray my own background is listening to a lot of punk music in this. This is a band called Kletka Red. And kind of a nice counterpoint to that, here's more of a spoken word performance kind of sound.
540
Shelley Hirsch.
Hemlock Street. 544 Hemlock Street. 544 Hemlock Street. Four stories high, and our family moved to the top. And there were four kids in my family, and we had four rooms. The kitchen had copper and turquoise stenciled walls, and there were two bedrooms. One of them was coral colored, and the other one was lilac.
Okay. And this is a group called Bar Kokhba playing some of John Zorn's compositions. He himself has composed now almost 300 different musical pieces on Jewish themes. So the avant-garde crowd has picked up on Jewish music in a big way. There's more of these records coming out all of the time. I get emails on a regular basis from these folks about new stuff coming out. It's truly, truly a staggering amount of new cultural material being put out. The Millikan Archive has a slightly different take on this. While they're encouraging of new work, and I'm going to play in a moment an example, what they are trying to do is catalog and inventory the output of Jewish classical music over the last 100 years. This is not a small undertaking. They have 300 recordings out at this point, something along there. I keep getting an advertisement, you know, to buy all 300 in one big block, and I'm this close. You know, I actually probably already have 30 of them, so it's, you know, harder sell. But they are one by one. These are all new recordings. These are all new performances of music over the last 100 years. Some brand new music, some older pieces. Let me give you an example here. So this is a personal favorite of mine by a composer named Ofer Ben Amos. Here I'm going to play one other one, a track from the album Jewish Music of the Dance. This track is from a suite called The Man of Midian by Stephen Wolfe, I believe is the composer. Thank you. to kind of close this off, I have to talk about jazz, right? So John Zorn, jazz musician, but his label isn't particularly focused on jazz, though it offers a lot. We talked a little bit about some of the art music, the classical music repertoire that's growing and developing. The jazz music scene is exploding as well. There are countless jazz groups that are bringing in Jewish themes at one level or another across the United States. So I'm going to show you two quick examples of kind of some of their output. First, one of the kind of great klezmer slash jazz musicians is a trumpet player named Frank London, who has played here in the area many times. This is a group of his called Hasidic New Wave. He has about five groups. This is one of them. I'm going to play you one more example, and this is one of my personal favorites. So in addition to Frank London, the kind of who is part of the more organized kind of avant-garde jazz community, one of my favorite Jewish jazz musicians is a fellow named David Shevin out of Connecticut, which is where I grew up, so a little nod to my hometown. He has a wonderful band called the Afro-Semitic Experience, where he and a fellow named Warren Bird, who is a keyboard player, have done an amazing job of fusing Jewish and African musical traditions. And while I absolutely adore their musical output, even more I love David Shevin's solo work, which still plays with the same group, but where David really is able to bring forth his Jewish experience even more. So now I'm going to pick one at random, because I forget which one I was going to pick. So here's an example of David Shevin's work from his Yisker suite. High art is booming, right? From the avant-garde to the jazz to the classical, more and more Jewish musicians and more labels are, and more venues are bringing forth kind of the Jewish cultural experience onto the main stage, the high art stages. And again, that's not the end of the story, though. So we've had low art, we've had high art, now the no art scene, right? The downtown scene, the rock club, the folk club, what's going on the streets, the people who aren't deliberately tying themselves to any particular tradition but want to go out, have a few beers, play a few songs, and make some music happen. Okay, this is, for the record, where I come from. Right, I spend an awful lot of my life hanging out in bars with beers, listening to great bands that no one else will ever hear of because the band will break up the next day. It's my favorite style of music. If a band's been around for two albums, I'm already starting to worry that they've sold out. So here are a couple of wonderful examples of current bands who are coming at pop music from a Jewish experience of one kind or another. So the first one that I'm going to play is a wonderful punk group out of Boston called the Shandies. The Shandies are, if you know Yiddish, Shandies is a disgrace. Right? They're very proud of it. Right? Shandies basically thumbed their nose at pretty much everything that high art, mainstream Judaism would say is the important stuff right there. They're gay. They're political. They don't like Israel, particularly, or at least they're particularly against the Israeli government. They've got a lot to say, and they say it really eloquently when they get going. They're also wonderful people, if you ever get a chance to meet them. So this is a song specifically coming from that perspective. Well, I saw the temple fall. Now, imagine hearing them in a small club in Ypsilanti, the volume cranked up to 10, with the crowd just slam dancing, going crazy. And that was me about a year ago seeing them. And, you know, you should all have been there because it was a fabulous show. But they'll be back, they promised me. Fabulous, fabulous folks. So the next one I want you to hear is the band in the lower left corner, Sway Machinery. So Jeremiah Lockwood, the guy who's got the guitar and the mic there, grandson of a cantor, grew up loving and listening to Delta Blues as much as to his grandfather singing cantorial music, started a very promising career playing Delta Blues guitar. He's wonderfully good. And somewhere along the line made the connection that his own musical tradition, his grandfather's musical tradition, somehow was getting shut out of the Delta when he was just playing the Delta Blues and something was missing. And so this is what happens when a Delta Blues guy who's the grandson of a cantor figures out how to put them together. The thing that I always find amazing when I listen is how absolutely effortless the connection is between the two musical forms. You know, this is another one of my heavy rotation bands, so I've had lots of chance to listen to them. And there are a lot of times fusion music, to me, comes off tasting bad, right? You know, I can get somebody who plays kind of a gypsy violin playing with somebody who plays something like a jazz saxophone, and the combination is less than the individual musics are. But when fusion's done right, as in what we were just hearing, it just sounds inevitable. Like, it doesn't sound like a fusion music anymore. It's just that's the way the music works and comes out. And it takes somebody like a Jeremiah Lockwood to kind of show us the inevitability of those connections. Okay. I'm going to skip Girls in Trouble just because I don't want to play everything, but I do want to say that Girls in Trouble will be playing here in a couple of weeks, so there's another great band you should hear. But I want to jump right to the last one, Hebrew School. This is a fellow named David Griffin, who is the guitar player and trumpet player here on the track. They're fascinating because he comes from a whole other world, as far as I'm concerned. He plays, when he's not playing this, he plays in a faux French pop band. You know, for him, the best music ever written was written in the 1960s, the kind of 1960s mod bubblegum music that most of us are embarrassed to know about. But when he curates it and he sent me a mix of some of his favorite stuff, I'm like, this is just amazing. How come I had no idea? I'm like, oh yeah, because I'm a loser. That's why. Right, so, you know, because we all come at this with our own kind of musical biases, right? And so you just heard mine. My bias is all that stuff is really weak and mediocre, and he showed me exactly how much of an idiot I was. Which realistically is not hard to do. So this is what happens when he takes on Jewish music. The joy and the beauty in that just kills me, and partially just because of how surprising, I said, for me it is, that particular musical perspective can just come alive in that way. Okay. All right, and so to kind of close off talking about some popular music, I want to mention really quickly something that I refer to as fringe. I have to explain this because these are not musicians who are on the fringe in any normal sense. But what I mean by fringe, these are all pop musicians, is there's this world of Jewish music and people who know that they're playing Jewish music and who want to go see Jewish music and hear Jewish music. Then there's mainstream pop America, pop, you know, Beyonce, you know, whoever the latest top of the charts is, right? These worlds don't overlap all that much. The four bands that I played on the last slide, none of them are going after Beyonce's slot as top pop, right? Now, they absolutely play on stages with non-Jewish pop bands. They wouldn't ever develop an audience if they... Our community at this point is just not large enough. One of the reasons why I'm standing here, right, is to help kind of grow that. But they're coming at it from a very specific Jewish perspective, okay? Every once in a while, in the kind of history of kind of Jewish music in the United States, we hit a bubble where Jewish musicians are comfortable being Jewish on stage. Right, and I never begrudge anybody their stage presence, their stage performance. Right, this is all theater. Right, it doesn't matter what kind of music you're doing or what kind of performance you're doing. When you get up on stage, it's theater. No one's asked you to bring your home culture, your home religion, your home perspective onto the stage. You're doing a show, right? And so I don't begrudge a Jewish musician who gets up on a pop stage and doesn't ever mention that they're Jewish. That's just not part of their theater. But every once in a while, we get a bubble where we get a bunch of musicians who feel comfortable and strongly enough that they actually do that, right? A lot of people in the room are old enough that to remember when Barbara Streisand, Neil Diamond, Bette Midler were very comfortable being Jewish on stage. They're also very comfortable recording Christmas albums, theater, right? They're allowed their theater. They sold a bunch of albums. They were great albums, okay? I grew up in the 1970s, okay? I didn't want to hear Barbara Streisand. I didn't want to hear Neil Diamond. I have since learned that Neil Diamond is in fact amazing, but it took me 30 years before I was able to kind of publicly acknowledge that. I still haven't gotten there with Barbara, but that's all right. But right now we're in one of those bubbles again, and it's happening for a lot of reasons, right? But the important thing is that we've got musicians on the pop scene who are unrepentant pop musicians who are being Jewish in public and letting that influence their music. So Mattisyahu obviously is probably the best known, best recognized for this. For the people in the audience who haven't had a chance to hear of him, he is an Hasidic Jew. He does reggae and hip-hop music. He is phenomenally talented. One of his songs was just used as the unofficial theme song of the Winter Olympics by NBC, the television station who filmed it. He's making lots and lots of headlines. A slightly lesser known but equally talented musician is Regina Spektor. She is a kind of cabaret piano player style pop musician. She comes from Russian Ashkenazi Jewish stock. And she's a fascinating example of somebody who doesn't wear it on her sleeve. Mattisyahu, you take one look at him, you're like, okay, he's Jewish, right? You know, it's no question. Regina has every opportunity to not make a big issue of it and makes a big issue of it anyway. And so I'm going to want to show you a video of hers from a recent one of her recent songs, just to give you an idea of how somebody who doesn't have to be Jewish on stage is anyway.
No one laughs at God in a hospital. No one laughs at God in a war. No one's laughing at God when they're starving or freezing or so very poor. No one laughs at God when a doctor calls after some routine tests. No one's laughing at God when it's gotten real late and their kid's not back from that party yet. No one laughs at God when their airplane starts to uncontrollably shake. No one's laughing at God when they see the one they love hand in hand with someone else and they hope that they're mistaken. No one laughs at God when the cops knock on their door and they say, "We got some bad news, sir." No one's laughing at God when there's a famine, fire, or flood. But God could be funny at a cocktail party while listening to a cuckoo joke. But when the crazy say he hates us and they get so red in the head, you think they're about to choke. God could be funny when told he'll give you money if you just pray the right way. And when presented like a genie with his magic like Houdini, or grants wishes like Jiminy Cricket and Santa Claus, God could be so hilarious, ha ha. Hospital. No one laughs at God in a war. No one's laughing at God when they've lost all they got and they don't know what for. No one laughs at God on a day they realize that the last sight they'll ever see is a pair of hateful eyes. No one's laughing at God when they're saying their goodbyes. But God could be funny at a cocktail party while listening to a say he hates us and they get so red in the head, you think they're about to choke. God could be funny when told he'll give you money if you just pray the right way. And when presented like a genie who does magic like Houdini, or grants wishes like Jiminy Cricket and Santa Claus, God could be so hilarious. But no one laughs at God in a hospital. No one laughs at God in a war. No one's laughing at God. We're all laughing with God.
Okay, so that's halfway there, right? You know, so this is a wonderful kind of religious-themed video that has actually kind of taken a lot of the religious community, both Christian and Jewish, by storm. In fact, I've been interested to see exactly how many, if you start looking around for information on this song, how many times it turns up in Christian pastors' sermons. So it's kind of an interesting perspective, right? So, you know, how Jewish is Jewish, right? So this is Regina Spektor on stage at one of her concerts last year, blowing the shofar the day before Rosh Hashanah. And let me tell you, if I was 18 years old and I knew there was a musician out there named Regina Spektor who's playing before Rosh Hashanah and is going to be blowing the shofar, I would have driven hours to see that concert. I drove hours for much less. Lots of hours for much less. I think 17 was my record for one show. They were a good band. So anyway, for me, the amazing thing is that we're at one of those bubbles right now. Not just Yiddish folk, not just these folk music, not the high art music, but the pop musicians are starting to make an issue of it and starting to be very comfortable with it. I knew I was kind of onto this when my brother, who's not a Jewish music fan, even in the slightest, even remotely, even accidentally, called me up. He's actually a Phish fan, if you guys know the band Phish. They just pulled the curtains on themselves recently, but they were kind of the replacement for the Grateful Dead. They were kind of a big guitar jam band kind of band. And my brother, who's seen them a dozen times in concert, called me up on his way home from a concert to tell me that they just played Avinu Malkeinu. Okay? And they meant it. And it wasn't a joke. Like, toward the end of the set, when they were kind of loose and kind of winding down and getting into kind of a more serious mode in the show, they took one of the deepest Jewish prayers and did a jam band version of it on stage and meant it. And, you know, something's happening in the zeitgeist when that starts to happen. Okay? All right, so this has all been popular music, folk music, but Jewish music is religious too, right? Judaism is a religion. It's not just a culture. Depending on who you are, one is more important than the other. I kind of stand firmly planted in both. Another big mainstay of Jewish music, another big bubble that's happening right now, is the song leader community. Okay? Jewish liturgy has changed and grown a lot over the last couple of decades. Not that any of the classic liturgy has gone away, but there's been a lot of new contenders for kind of the top slot of how Jews should be praying. Probably the most notable is the Reform song leader community. And it's not strictly Reform. There are conservative and Orthodox musicians who are involved in this, but it's predominantly Reformed for a variety of reasons, which are a great discussion, you know, for later on. Okay, so I'm going to give you a couple of examples. I'm being sneaky about this. I'm being publicly sneaky. The specific ones I'm picking are actually going to be playing here at the Jewish Music Festival in Detroit in 2 weeks. So this is Rabbi Joe Black, who is a wonderful musician and songwriter. You'll hear in a second. This is a Michigan. Remember I said Jewish music actually does happen here in Michigan? Zillian Serling. She is not as much of a liturgical songwriter as much as a family folk songwriter, but a wonderful musician in her own right. And I'll play you a couple of quick examples of this. And I realize they're getting on to two. I'm taking a little longer than I had meant, so I'll try to speed things up a little bit. All right. So here's something from Rabbi Joe Black from a few years ago. It's important when you hear this to understand he doesn't want you to clap. He wants you to sing.
A time ago, in a land called Modin, lived a young man named Judah, brave and serene. When Antiochus the tyrant said the Jews could not be free, he didn't count on Judah, the one called Maccabee.
All right, so I want you to imagine someone standing at the front of temple, playing guitar and singing that way. And if you haven't actually been to that experience, you should come to Temple Beth Emmet on a regular basis, particularly when they do Friday Night Live, Shabbat Live. What's the actual phrase? The TV?
Shabbat
Alive. Okay? And you'll get a whole prayer service exactly like that. And that kind of a prayer service led like that is becoming more and more common across the Reform community. Not in exclusion of traditional liturgy, but as a supplement to it. Depending on what temple you're at, one or the other may be vying for prominence. And there's a whole history of where this came out of. It came out of the Reform summer camp movement. It came out of influences of Hasidic Nigunim. But it's really taking the liturgical world by storm. I'm going to give you one more example, just because it's one of my personal favorites. This is Craig Taubman's Romamu, which is the melody that's used at TBE all the time. This is the music for taking out the ark. You can think of a more joyful way to do it. I'd like to hear it.
Romamu, Adonai Eloheinu
Imagine a whole line of people carrying a Torah around your around the temple singing this. I get a lot of practice with that one. I still don't sing well, but I get a lot of practice with it. Okay, so the Reform Song Leader movement is another big, big anchor point in Jewish music right now. But even it doesn't hold a candle to the Orthodox and Hasidic music community. Now, this is one of the things that took me by total surprise when I got started writing and learning about Jewish music, because I'm not Orthodox or Hasid, right? I don't know. If you're not Orthodox and Hasid, you probably don't know very many people who are Orthodox and Hasid. You probably don't go to very many events or services that are in those communities. And so what's going on in those communities can be kind of surprising when you start getting into it. And sometimes the communities are referred to as being insular. And I think that's totally unfair. I'm using the term because I want to make sure everyone understands that it's not true. Okay? It's not in any sense of insularity. It's the sense that they just are under the radar of most American Jews, because we're much more focused on mainstream media and larger American culture, and these guys are much more focused on their own internal groups. They're defining their own culture on a daily basis. And boy, do they go at it with gusto. So I could give a 2-hour talk just on all the variants and energy going on in that community and still not have nearly enough time. So let me give you a couple quick examples. So this is an example of shiny shoe music. Okay? You can imagine a bunch of guys in black hats up on stage looking disturbingly like a 1970s lounge act. That's what this would look like. And once again, they're very serious about it. This is what Hasidic and Orthodox music on the big stage looks like right now. To me, this is sort of like the French pop music, where I was like, you're kidding me. When I first learned about it, the more I've listened to it, the more I've gotten addicted to it. Like, a lot of the Jewish music I get because people have mailed it to me. These guys don't mail me much, but I go out and I bought a ton of it. You can ask my daughters, they have to listen to this way more than they probably want to. It's more than they'll admit to. Okay, so I mentioned Shlomo Carlebach a moment ago. Big Hasidic rabbi in the 70s and 80s, introduced this whole 1970s folk music to the Hasidic community. He has since passed on, but there's a whole generation of musicians that are following after him. So Yehuda Green, who's the second one there, this is a great example of kind of a neo-Karlbach kind of folk music approach. So the Orthodox and the Hasidic communities, they've got pop bands, the boys' choirs, which are absolutely fascinating. This is what happens in a community where women aren't allowed to sing in public, and you've got really well-organized boys' schools, the yeshivas, the religious schools. What you end up with is a community that has lots of very, very popular boys' choirs, both in terms of all boys on stage singing, but also a lot of the best of the boys end up singing along with the shiny shoe musicians, acting to get you kind of a wider vocal range. You've got the adult baritone or tenor singing with a 15-year-old soprano, and you get a very interesting kind of musical sound. Cantorial, okay? In the conservative reform movements, when we say cantors, there's almost quotes around it, right? Cantors don't often sing in what would be considered a classic cantorial style. They're performing the function, they're singing, they're leading the communities, but there's a defined style, okay? In the Hasidic world, that still exists. By the way, this is Blue Fringe, a modern Orthodox pop band. You realize this is going to kick over. Okay, the cantorial is alive and well in those communities. You know, big barrel-chested guy is belting it out in full operatic style, and they can pack Madison Square Gardens, and they do. By the way, all of these things pack Madison Square Gardens, and I don't mean that as hyperbole. That's a standard place that gets rented out for these shows. Okay, and one of these days I'm going to go to one because I really, really have come to love this music, and I just haven't had an opportunity yet. Okay, so almost there with the music, and then we'll be wrapping this up. So two last bits. One, kind of closing off American Jewish music, family music has always been pivotal. This is the music that if you walk into your average Judaica shop, whether it's at Temple Beth Emmet, at Beth Israel, you go to the suburbs of Detroit into a Judaica shop, this is what's going to be on the shelves, right? What we're talking about is Jewish American lifestyle and life cycle. We're talking about kids' albums, we're talking about wedding music, we're talking about Hanukkah music, Purim, right? There is Purim music. And what's been amazing is that, so this has always been out there. Every few years, a few new albums have come out, it's rotating. But the amount of new material that's coming out over the last few years is just staggering, including stuff of really high production value and really high songwriting quality. So the Oi Baby, I'm going to point to two or three here that I think are a particular note. So Oi Baby in the top right-hand corner, absolutely fabulous pair of kids albums. The producer got two sisters who awesome voices to record a whole bunch of Jewish music, and this was standard rotation in my car for about 4 years. I could probably list every song on there, and I still like them. That's, for me, that's the testament of a good kids' album, is that as the adult, I still like it. I can tell you that's not always the case. Jewish kids' music is not just in New York, right? So the photo in the bottom right, some of you may recognize that this is Gemini. They're Ann Arbor, two brothers, fabulous, if you ever get a chance to see them. They don't sing strictly Jewish music. They do a lot of secular folk music. They're wonderful no matter what they're doing. And it's one of those kids of all ages things. I fully qualify as a kid of all ages, so I get to say that. On the holiday music, I'm going to crank up one of my daughter's favorite songs. Eva, this one's for you. So this is Aaron Baron Cohen. This is this album right here, which is a fabulous kind of jazz, hip-hop, electronica, Hanukkah album that came out last year. It's got a fellow named Y Love, who's a hip-hop, Jewish, Orthodox Jewish hip-hop musician, singing.
My Hanukkah, Zos Hanukkah, whole Mikdash spot got blown like harmonicas. Illumination, scintillation, a nation awakened. Against assimilation, learn the Torah from the spinning tops. Eight nights, keep it hot, represent for what we got. The battle on the mountaintop, Gimel Shin, Hey Noon, inauguration in salute. Big cup, hey, kiss, slave, Haim Khanu. Ancient Indians got shown who is real, be with. Ad hoc kingdom brings in freedom. Illicit wisdom infiltrated, just a Pach Shemin. Down with Antiochus, up with all the priestly zealots. We built the temple, not trying to be heroes. Now go no lose tradition of dudes from Peloponnesos. The Hellenistic, squashed by the realistic. They was checking aesthetics while we checked the metaphysics. My Hanukkah, Zos Hanukkah.
Keep the fire alive.
My Hanukkah, Zos Hanukkah.
Keep the fire alive.
My Hanukkah, Zos Hanukkah.
Keep the fire alive.
My Hanukkah, Zos Hanukkah.
It ain't just a candle, this is why we light.
The year was 3620.
Okay, so again, we've been doing this kind of music for a long time. Right, the Judaica stores have always been well stocked. If you want to walk in and get a Passover album, they're there. But the quality of the performances, the production, the songwriting has just gone up astronomically in the last 10 years. There's always been a couple of really outstanding albums. Now it's becoming hard to find ones that aren't outstanding albums. And again, we're just on this rising bubble. Okay, and the last slide of the music before I get to my pitch, you're going to be pitched to in a minute. Brace yourselves. It's Israel. Okay, you can't talk about American Jewish music without mentioning Israel. It's not American Jewish music, but the connection between American Jews and Israel is deep in a lot of different levels, and American Jews are listening to Israeli music. If you go to a Jewish music festival, there's going to be Israeli musicians or Israeli music being performed. It's just part of the cultural landscape and the cultural zeitgeist. I can't go through all of the amazing Israeli bands. There's not nearly time. And I can't go through all the styles. Every style that you've heard me talk about here also exists in Israel, plus a whole bunch more stuff that hasn't made it across yet. These are just a couple of my personal favorite musicians. In the top left, you've got David Brosa, who I actually saw for the first time at the Seattle Jewish Musical Fest about 10 years ago. Frank Chilik, who is a klezmer clarinet player. In klezmer, I mean, excuse me, in Israel, klezmer does not mean at all what I was talking about earlier. So as I was saying about different terminology, the word klezmer and what's associated with a klezmer musician is totally different, overlapping, but different. Noah, the bottom right, who is right now probably the leading ticket sales of any Israeli music performer. She just got beat out on the Eurovision Song Contest this past year. Israel was heartbroken. And in the top right, I'm going to play you a quick track. This is one of my absolute favorite Israeli bands. They're called Hadag Nachash, which roughly translates to snakefish. They're a hip-hop group. And the reason why I want you to hear it is they're a great example of what happens when Israelis take on kind of an American form. It sounds the same, but not. And so it's a good example. And then we're gonna get to the pitch. Okay, where is Israel? If you know the Hebrew, all of the expressions come from bumper stickers that you would see in Israel. I don't know the Hebrew, but this is what I'm told.
שלום, תנו לצהל לנצח, עם חזק עושה שלום, תנו לצהל לקסח, אין שלום עם ערבים, אל תיתנו להם רובים, קרבי זה הכי, הכי גיוס.
Okay, so I love that we're talking about the Mizrahi music, which has a deep connection to kind of Arabic music. You can hear that flowing underneath the kind of more American urban hip-hop vocals. So it's one of the, I remember back, this shows my age, right? I remember back when rap and hip-hop just kind of first burst onto the cultural landscape, and there was a big argument in the community, in that community, about whether there should be a Grammy for rap music. And a lot of people in the rap community said there shouldn't be because it's a vocal form. It's not a musical form. You can rap over any music. Therefore, how could you have a rap Grammy? They lost. There ended up being one. But this is just a great example, right, where they're taking a particular vocal form and putting it over local music. Okay, so I hope that over the last hour, I have kind of given you kind of a roadmap. I haven't shown you 1/10 of the great stuff that's going on out there, but there is just so much amazing music coming from so many different angles right now that we really are on a wonderful bubble that I am calling, and I've gotten some other people in the community to refer to as the Silver Age of Jewish music. Saying that it's a Silver Age kind of asks the question, well, how come it's not a Golden Age, right? And so I'm going to wrap up like in a couple more slides, and I'm going to explain to you why it's not the Golden Age and kind of point you toward where, how I think it can become a Golden Age. Because you all need to help. Okay, so first of all, when was the Golden Age of Jewish American music? Well, it was then, right? It was the tenements, it was the 1920s, it was the great waves of immigration into New York, Detroit, Cleveland, Vancouver, Montreal, and Jews were living in tight quarters. Ashkenazi Jews were living in tight quarters. And the result of living in tight quarters is that you had amazing cultural dynamics of people who were desperately trying to hold on to their cultural identity that they brought, at the same time trying to radically assimilate to the new world that they found themselves. There was a study done once about the rate of time of which emigrating communities lost their native religion, not native religion, native language, and adopted English as the dominant language. Yiddishkeit beat out everybody in terms of how fast Ashkenazi Jews got rid of Yiddish. Almost immediately when they got here. It was amazing. So my grandparents, who spoke Yiddish, refused to teach my parents Yiddish and would only sort of acknowledge that they spoke Yiddish in my presence. Right? But while this was happening, there was this amazing sense of possibility. Right? It was a new world. There was a lot of energy. You had amazing bands playing the old world music while incorporating it into the new world music, and it created this wonderful dynamic where everybody was listening to music. Okay? And not just music. They were going to theater. There were Yiddish theaters. There were Yiddish radio stations. There were newspapers. And this was all in a couple of blocks, right? It wasn't that there was one. We still have a wonderful Yiddish newspaper in the United States, but we have one, okay? In the 1920s, there'd be one in every block. And so everybody was tightly wrapped in their local communities. And because of that, word of mouth spread. If there was a new band, a new thing going on, everybody knew about it immediately. This was the defining culture. It wasn't a secondary thing in their lives, okay? But that's gone, right? We don't live in that world anymore, and we haven't lived in that world for almost 100 years at this point. Okay, we don't, as American Jews, have that kind of defining culture. We are much, much more part of the global American culture. Even so, for me, this was, growing up, this was critically true. I grew up in a small forest town in Connecticut. The nearest synagogue was 20 minutes, and we went all the time. And I didn't actually get along with most of the kids there, right? I didn't have much of a Jewish community. But even talking to my family and friends who grew up in suburbs that were definingly Jewish, their experience wasn't all that much different than mine. Yeah, they went to a lot more bar mitzvahs than I did. And they actually liked the kids at the bar mitzvahs more than I did. But in terms of feeling that they were Jewish on a daily basis and being surrounded by a Jewish culture on a daily basis, yeah, not so much. Not in that kind of sense. Okay? Now, that isn't true everywhere, right? Remember I said about the Orthodox and Hasidic communities? They never lost that. That's what defines them, in fact, is that they push the rest of the U.S. away as much as they can possibly do to hold on to that sense of tight community. It's partially based on religious orientation, right? There's whole sets of religious rules that if they were to follow, they need to be able to push the rest of the world away. But also is to help preserve, deliberately to preserve that sense of tight community. And they're very, very conscious of that and very successful at it. Okay? Jewish music didn't die. I don't want to give anyone the opinion that somehow around 1935, Jewish music got wiped off the map and wasn't reinvented until yesterday. And that's certainly not true. In the 1950s and 60s, there was Jewish music, but it was marginalized. It was self-referential. While there were a couple of bright spots, there wasn't much going on. As the great Catskill resorts started to close up, the whole notion of kind of Jewish entertainment started to die. You had a couple of interesting albums pop up, the Latin Jewish craze of the 50s, Desi Arnaz, all of that kind of stuff, but not a lot. It started to rebound in the 70s. So the 70s is when the Klezmer revival hit, when people like Henry Sapaznik started to dig into the dustbins, literally into the dustbins, to pull out old 78s and to try to find the few remaining musicians who had actually played with the musicians of the 20s to try to rebuild the knowledge of that cultural landscape. You had people like Shlomo Carlebach in putting a whole bunch of new energy into the Hasidic community with his folk style. Debbie Friedman helping to kick off the song leader movement that I mentioned. And then you had coming up later folks like the Diaspora Yeshiva Band and Flori Jagoda. Flori is a Sephardic Jew from the Balkans who helped put a lot, composing new material in the Sephardic tradition. And folks like her and the Diaspora Yeshiva Band were able to kind of start making things happen because of the world music movement of the 80s. Right? In the 80s, we reached this point where all of a sudden, music industry was globalized. If you were a local band from Spain, Ireland, wherever, it wasn't good enough to be the best band there. You were now competing on a world stage. And if you sounded just like the band in New York, you were going to always lose to the band in New York. So the whole idea of world music had nothing to do with the music industry was not all about, let's honor local traditions at all. It was all about musicians being able to market themselves, right? If you were a rock band who played with a Spanish sound, cool. Nobody in New York is doing that, right? You now get a place on the main stage. And in fact, if you go into Borders or if you go into any music store and look for Jewish music, 100% guarantee it's all going to be in the world music category. Unless you happen to be at the one of the few that actually has like a religious Christian and Jewish section. It will always be in the world music community, and that's why. Okay? So that gets us back to now. But like I said, growing up, middle America, I didn't know anything about it. For me, Jewish music on mainstream media was Adam Sandler singing the Hanukkah song. Woohoo. Okay? Great song. I don't want to knock it, but that was about it. Okay, the internet's helped change all of this because now distance doesn't matter. I can go out and find things that aren't in my local community. I can go out and help go get stuff, This is why my blog is possible. My blog wouldn't have been possible pre-internet. I couldn't have written a weekly column in a newspaper 15 years ago that does what my blog does, because I wouldn't have been able to find out about all of this stuff. Because while there is Jewish music going on in Michigan, lots of it, most of it isn't, right? Michigan's just one corner of all of this. Okay, that's a word of mouth problem, right? If we don't have a big mainstream media, which we don't, unfortunately, Jewish media, such as it is, I'm talking about things like The Forward, Moment magazine, typically are aimed at a older population, not a 20-year-old, right? So as a 20-year-old, I would never have read those articles. They're great magazines, but they're not our newspapers, but I wouldn't have read them, right? And they don't typically look at new, hip, interesting things going on, because that's typically not what that age demographic is interested in. They're interested, that age demographic tends to be more interested in politics and the politics of religion than it is about the latest indie pop band coming on. That's not a bad thing. It's just you're not going to find out by reading Moment. It's not up until very recently. But your friends can tell you. And the great thing about the internet and social networks is my friends do tell me, and I tell them. So this is me coming back from a Daniel Kahn show. Remember, he was the Yiddish socialist anarchist that I mentioned earlier. He's from Michigan. He actually lives in Germany now, but he comes back and plays all the time. And so I came back to tell everybody on Facebook that I'm friends with about what an amazing show it was. So two of the people who responded that they liked the show were people from my Jewish music scene. Yeah, they already liked Daniel Kahn. They already knew about him. But two of the people are friends of mine from college who had never heard of him, never would have heard of him, but now know of him. Do they like him? Are they going to go see him in a show? I don't know. Maybe, maybe not, probably not. But they know about him now. And that's the thing. Media is about having people know stuff. And if you don't know it, you can't act on it. Okay? Two great examples of bands trying to make people know about it happen. So Stereo Sinai and Can Can. Stereo Sinai, Chicago. Okay? Almost local. They qualify in my world. Bibblegum pop. That's what they refer to themselves as, okay? They get on social networks. They talk to people, and they're making stuff happen. They got hooked up with an Israeli charity, Pioneers for a Cure, got a track on their CDs. All of this is happening by word of mouth. Each place where they are connecting are telling people about it. They talk to me. I tell people through my blog, and people are getting to know about them. Can Can, punk band from Atlanta, guy is, Patrick, starts a weekly video blog called Punk Torah. He gives a Devar Torah every week. This is a punk band, and he's giving a Devar Torah every week, okay? And the word of mouth starts to build, right? He gets connected with the Jewlicious Festival. His group has flown out to California last week to play at the premier Jewish concert series for the 20 to 30-year-olds. It's out of L.A., it's a fabulous concert series, okay? And importantly, they're telling us about all of this stuff, okay? Which leads to me and to you, right? Because I write a blog. I find out about this stuff. My only reason for doing this blog is to help tell people about this stuff. I mean, me learning about it is great, but I could do that without writing a blog. For me, it's all about telling people, because if we want the Silver Age to turn into a Golden Age, we need to have people know. So my parting shot to everybody here is go buy a CD if you heard one that you like. Go to a concert. There happens to be it just so happens that the Jewish Music Fest in Detroit is in 2 weeks. There are flyers at the door. Rabbi Joe Black that I played is going to be there. Mattis Yahu won't be there in person, but he will be playing in New York, but we're going to get a satellite feed of the show. So if you come to the Music Fest, you'll get to see him and actually email and talk back and forth with him through a satellite feed. Okay? You can go online and hear. There's internet radio stations from all over the world, from South America, from Israel. I was talking to some folks from Chai FM, which is a 24-hour Jewish radio station out of Johannesburg, South Africa, just this week. Okay, all of this is available. So if you heard anything that you thought was interesting, anything that you liked, just go out and look for that one thing. But even more important than that is tell someone. Okay? There's great stuff happening, but nobody knows. Not nearly enough people know. So just go tell somebody that you came to the talk. Say that you heard some stuff that sounded interesting and maybe they would like it, send them to my blog or not, send them to somewhere else or not, but just tell people this stuff is going on, because that's how we make this into a golden age. Okay, thank you.
Anyone have any questions for Jack?
If you grab, so I mentioned informally before, but I'll mention formally now. I made a cheat sheet of today's talk. Every band that I mentioned is listed on here, and the very first thing that's listed is the address of my blog, so you can get in touch with me or go look at it. Yep, they're right over by the door. Okay. Any other questions?
Well, in the spirit of your talk,
sure.
Let people know that on Saturday, March 20th, mm-hmm. Israeli horn clarinetist Annette Cohen will be at Cliff Bell's Jazz Club in Detroit.
Awesome.
Music of Django
Reinhardt. Oh, awesome.
She's one of the rising stars in the jazz right now, and she's moved from Israel to from Tel Aviv to Brooklyn, and is just tearing it up.
Awesome.
And her brother is a trumpet player. And they play Jewish-influenced music combined with jazz on their own work, and it's just beautiful. That's what drew me to the talk.
Oh, that's great. What was her name?
Annette.
Annette.
Annette, yeah.
Uh-huh, Annette Cohen. And she's great, thank you. Because one of the things I do on my blog is I try to publicize Michigan and Upper Midwest Jewish music events, and so that'll go right on my list. So I appreciate that, thanks.
Well, I just wanted to mention that many of the people that you refer to here mm-hmm. have appeared at the music festivals at the JCC in Detroit.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's the quality of the
festival. Absolutely, absolutely. And I mentioned at one point earlier, and I'll mention again, that Ann Arbor is a great place to hear Jewish music. With the venues like the Ark, like the University Music Series, and the whole set of jazz and rock clubs that are playing in the area, there's a steady stream of events for me to go to, so many that I actually don't get to go to all of them, which is really, really sad. I missed the Shandies on the last tour. It was very depressing. Hi, you. This is Lila. This is my younger daughter. Well, she was. We're going to go to Purim in a few minutes. Well, thank you very much, everybody. I really appreciate the chance to talk to you. Thank you.